As I said last week, we talked about the race run before us and that we must be prepared for faithful endurance to the end of that race. You might recall what we said last week, that Satan does not care now if you are doing well, as long as you're not prepared to finish the race. That's what he's banking on. He's actually banking on that you're not prepared for that. So think about that idea that you can easily overcome Satan. I don't mean it's going to be easy to overcome, but you can easily overcome the strategy of Satan by simply being prepared for his attacks. And there are going to be attacks. Part of that preparation is being ready for the ambushes along the way. And you have to keep in mind, like you see on the screen there, we're not running in neutral territory. It's not friendly territory here that we're running through. It's like running through a militarized zone, a war zone. So there's going to be assaults and attacks, and we need to be prepared for that. The truth is, most Christians will be attacked by an ambush at one time or another. And that's just part of the walk, or the race, rather, in this case, of being a Christian. A lot of people never see it coming. Some people don't know what an ambush even looks like, and you can't fight against an unknown enemy, or what an enemy that is not defined for you. Some don't know how to defend against the ambushes. They know the enemy's out there, and they see him, but they don't know what to do. That's why we're doing this lesson here. So while running the race, we need to keep our eyes wide open. We need to keep our feet on the path. We need to keep ourselves ready to resist the enemy. All right, brief introduction. Now let's just dive in, right? Because I got lots of stuff to say, and I don't want to have time to say it. Ambush comes from a French word in the 15th century, which simply means from the sticks of wood or sticks of firewood, literally from the woods, from the forests, from the trees, as though someone was hiding in the trees. Imagine a pathway through the woods. You've all seen it in the movies. Maybe you've been on a path through the woods, Mount Rainier or something like that, and you're on this path, and there's trees all around you. And the idea there is that you're walking on the path, minding your own business, and then suddenly from out of nowhere, you're attacked. And that's the idea from this word. It's a surprise attack from a secret or unknown position. It's meant to specifically confuse or disorient or disable the enemy. We know it today as guerrilla warfare. Snipers, hit and run, sneak attacks, etc., all that sort of thing. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Patriot or The Patriot, but there's a pretty illustrative scene there where the British are marching through the woods and then the American colonists are attacking from the trees, and it's exactly that scenario that we're talking about, okay? That exact same thing. Satan uses this kind of attack or an ambush here because most people are unprepared for it and they're uneducated as to what it is, and they're too distracted with their own lives to notice the movement in the bushes. They don't see things going on in the side there. We've talked about it before. Satan is portrayed as a roaring lion, 1 Peter 5, verse 8. He's a roaring lion seeking to devour people. And someone says, in essence, well, if I see a lion, well, then I'm going to take precaution. Well, that makes sense, right? And likely, however, you won't see this attack. Because instead of a roaring lion, what Satan often attacks us with is flaming missiles or fiery darts. We're being hit from out of nowhere. And that's the illustration Paul uses there in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 16. So no matter how hard you try, some missiles are going to find you. And so you need to have your shield of faith. It's part of that full armor of God that we talked about that's so critically important. Faith extinguishes these missiles because of your clinging to God and appealing to his truth and his strength and his providence. And you've got to believe that Satan is no match for God. That's part of your belief system. Satan is no match for God. If I ally myself with God, then I'm going to be defended against Satan's attacks. That doesn't mean he won't attack, and it doesn't mean that you won't be hit. It means that even though you're hit, it will not disable you. It will not render you incapacitated. Unfortunately, many Christian men and women say things like, oh, an ambush will never happen to me. Well, that's either not being honest or just allowing yourself to be self-deceived, because it just does happen. It's going to happen. It's kind of like walking down the middle of I-5 at rush hour thinking, I'm not going to get hit. Well, yeah, not only are you going to get hit, you're going to get pulverized, okay? It's going to happen. You put yourself in that territory under those conditions, it's going to happen. So think about this race that is set before us. You put yourself in that race, things are going to happen to you. You just bet on it. You can bank on it. You can guarantee it's going to happen, right? That's just the way it is. So our objective then is, first of all, if possible, don't give Satan a clear shot and an open opportunity. And then secondly, take some proactive measures so that if you are hit, at least you have some kind of resource there to help you, some kind of response to that. So you have to realize that ambushes don't just hurt you yourself. They also hurt your family. That's why this is part of the family and home series that we're doing on Sunday morning. Largely on Sunday morning, is because of this very thing. Families get hit by some of these ambushes, as we'll talk about, and you'll see that. And so it's not just you that Satan's after. He wants to take down your whole family. In fact, it would be very pleasurable to Satan if he could take down an entire congregation through a few well-placed ambushes. Think about that. There's a strategy here. Satan is a strategist. Satan has a tactile strategy that he uses. He's not just bumbling along like sometimes we are. He's not just bumbling along not knowing what to do. He's very organized. He's very resourceful. He's very good at what he does. I'm not giving him compliments. I'm just simply acknowledging these as facts. He's very good at what he does. And others have said, well, I've been ambushed in the past, and so now I'm never going to be good enough for anything because I've just been injured in the ambush. Well, Satan's very proud of you for having succumbed to that kind of thinking, that kind of reasoning, because that's exactly what he wants you to say. He wants you to recognize that now that you've been attacked and you've been injured, now you're useless and no good to anything or anyone, and especially God. You see, the thing is that Satan doesn't even have to finish us off. We actually finish ourselves off with our own guilt and shame and humiliation. Isn't that sad that we do things like that? One of the tactics that men have used in ages past when horses were regularly used in warfare is that they would hamstring the enemy's horses. And what they're doing is they're cutting the back tendons of the horse's legs so that the horses, they can walk, but they can't run and they can't pull anything. They're basically big, useless 800-pound animals that are absolutely of no use or value for anyone now, right? And so the idea was then you don't have to go killing the horses. All you do have to do is just render them incapacitated. And that's exactly what they do. And I'm wondering how many Christians have been hamstrung by Satan. They're just walking around, perfectly useless, if you will, and all because they think that Satan has that kind of power. Jesus is the great physician. And if you're hit and injured, well, then go to him. Let him help. Trust his power to heal. Get back on the course and start running again. Because you cannot afford not to finish this race. All right, having said all that, there are going to be many different attacks that can hit us broadside and knock the wind out of us, but there's three common ones, and these are not necessarily in order. There's three common ones we're going to talk to about tonight in this lesson here. And the first of these is the ambush of another woman, or if you're a woman, the ambush of another man. I'm just going to pick on the men as though they're the ones being ambushed here. Not that that's more common necessarily, but just because it's just easier, all right? So we're not talking about here a close friend. We're not talking here about a mutual friend of the family and so on. We're talking really about an intruder in the marriage, okay? So again, we're not talking about a kindred spirit that you may have of the opposite sex. We're talking about someone who is actually interfering with and dividing that marriage that you have with your wife or wives with your husbands. That's what we're dealing with here. Marital infidelity is one of the most seductive weapons in Satan's arsenal. It is aimed at the weakest and most undefended points in a person's heart, that need to be loved or to love, and that insatiable need for attention, and especially that of the opposite sex. Can't say we don't have that, right? We do have that. We're wired that way. God made us that way. And so that can be abused, and we can transgress the boundaries of all that, or we can use that in a proper manner. We're talking here about the abuse or transgression of those needs here. So we're dealing here with two separate but related and extremely powerful attractants. The first of these is human emotions, often illogical and highly influential dynamics of how the mind works. Human emotions often see what isn't there and yet at the same time denies reality. Okay, there's that illogic part of the scenario there. Human emotions also gravitate toward the path of least resistance. And once they are aroused, they are not easily ignored and often take on a life of their own. Now, what I just said could probably be expounded into an entire textbook on human psychology, okay? Because there's a lot there to what I just said. My point here is not to burden all of us with all the details, but simply to acknowledge the facts of this is what we're dealing with. We are dealing with human emotions, and we're also dealing with another thing that God gave to us for a good reason, but that can be misused and abused, and that is physical bodily chemistry. And of course, we're talking about the adrenaline and endorphin loaded high or thrill that two people feel when they let their guard down and begin imagining what if, and then begin fantasizing about all kinds of scenarios. Oh, if only I could be with you instead of my wife, you know. And if only I could be with, you know, you instead of my husband. And that sort of thing, that sort of fascination and imagination and that surreal sort of high that we get there when the chemistry between two people gets ignited. I know none of you know what I'm talking about, but let's just pretend, okay, that we know what we're talking about. No, of course, that's how we get married, right? Is we found someone and that chemistry was lit up and we got attracted to each other. There's nothing wrong with that in itself. But there's something wrong with that when you are already married and then you start having that with someone else and you do nothing about it, but actually, you know, pour gasoline on the fire, so to speak. So this often begins with, and again, I'm picking on the men here, it often begins when a husband looks upon another woman with lust in his heart, like Jesus says in Matthew 5:28. And a lot of people think that this has to be sexual lust, and it does not have to be sexual at all. Not all affairs are sexual in nature. Some of them are simply emotional affairs. They often turn into sexual later on if they've given enough time and opportunity, but they don't necessarily start that way. It's just an attraction. It's something that brings two people together. And so this man looks upon this woman, not necessarily with sexual lust, but an inappropriate way, an uncontrolled way, and with an ungodly desire. That's what the problem is. Everyone can appreciate a good-looking man or a good-looking woman that's not your husband or wife, right? They're out there, right? I guess. Anyway, you know, the idea here is that that's not the problem in itself. The problem is when you start going down this path that we're talking about and letting those emotions and that human bodily chemistry take action there and actually not just approving of that, but actually fanning the flames. So this person here does not see the flaws and the shortcomings and the issues of this other woman. All he sees is her ideal characteristics, and he begins to imagine this ideal woman, this ideal wife, and then he looks at his own wife and says, you know, I am kind of tired of her. We've been together for a while, and she is kind of like irritating sometimes, and she doesn't do everything that I want her to do, and she, you know, she says things to me sometimes I wish she wouldn't say them. He begins imagining all the flaws and the problems and the things that aren't perfect about his wife, and then when it comes to this woman here, oh, you know, angels singing, right? Big light down, and she's in a perfect light. She's always, notice this is almost always true, she's always on her best behavior. She's almost always well-dressed. You're seeing her in the ideal image. And then the wife, you know, she's got her hair in curlers and bathrobe, and you know what I'm saying? And so we start looking at this different image here, and we start fantasizing about the one and start actually unappreciating the other. And this is how these things go. And he doesn't see the danger or the warning signs, and he fans the flames of this newfound passion. Why? Well, because it feels good, and because it makes him happy, and it makes him wanted, and it makes him attractive to somebody. And I'm not saying that wives, you should say, well, if my husband, you know, I don't have to tell him how attractive I am or attracted to him that I am and so on. He can just figure that out. Well, maybe there is something to rewarding our spouses with compliments. If it's not about their looks and about what they do, okay? Because there are attacks out there. And one thing that you can do to keep your spouse interested in you is to focus on the good qualities that person has. But this other woman here is feeding these cravings that this man has, and he doesn't see how much he's going to lose. And usually he'll deny his feelings to others, or he's going to downplay the whole situation and go, nah, it's just not really that. And he'll detract the situation, you know, to other topics when someone brings it up, like, hey, you spent a lot of time with so-and-so. Ah, no, it's no big deal. And then, you know, we go off into a different discussion here. Now, what's the interesting thing here is that when someone gets caught up in this scenario, and if it were someone else and he was watching it, he'd go, whoa, that needs to stop right now. But when it's him, it's always different, isn't it? There's always rules to bend. You know, it's always more permissible. It's always more acceptable. It's because we get blindsided by emotionally and chemically, if you will, by those things that I talked about earlier. And before he knows it, he's in this emotional, chemical bond, which leads to a physical, passionate bond, which almost always, inevitably, leads to a sexual one. That's how it happens. It's not rocket science. It's just opportunity and someone taking advantage of that opportunity and not paying attention to the fact that he just got ambushed. And it wasn't by another woman so much. He got ambushed by Satan. And Satan simply used another woman in order to complete the process. Proverbs chapter 5, verse 15 through 18 is just one passage that we could use here. You can actually read down to the end of the chapter on your own if you want to. But in Proverbs chapter 5, if you turn with me there, we'll read a few verses. And just think about what the writer is teaching us here with regard to our wives or our husbands. I know the language here is figurative. I realize that. It's slightly poetic, if you will. But it's talking about very real and serious things. Drink water from your own cistern. Or a cistern is an underground pocket of water there that is purposely made for that very purpose, to have drinking water. And fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? Let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love, etc. And he talks about the danger of the adulteress. All right? So, I understand. Poetic imagery and so on. But very real and very important points. So let's extract from that then some things here. First of all, do not allow another woman or women, another man, to be an acceptable solution to your unhappy situation at home. Every time I think about doing lessons on this subject, which isn't a lot, but every time I think about doing that, I'm always thinking, what need is there for that? We've got a good group here, right? And there's not going to be any real danger. And that's just not true. This stuff happens. And if it doesn't happen here, it's going to happen in some other congregation. And it's all because there's an unhappy situation at home and someone looked outside the home for that solution to their unhappy situation. Instead of dealing with the problem and facing those conflicts or whatever is going on at home, instead of that, they're going outside and fantasizing about what if and how good it could be and so on. Do not respond to the flirting and unwanted attention and illicit advances of the opposite sex. It will be enticing, it will be exciting, and it will be difficult to turn away from all this, but you have to treat this as an ambush and not a friendly encounter. You have to realize that you're being attacked. Even though the enemy might look like she's got a great hairdo and lipstick and perfume, she still represents, in any way, the enemy. Okay? And that's how you have to look at this. Don't put yourself in questionable or intimate or compromising situations with a member of the opposite sex here. Have enough common sense to know what's going on. Have some foresight. And perhaps most of all at this point, have enough respect for your own spouse to avoid that scenario. Because that's really what you're doing when you allow yourself in those positions. You don't really have a whole lot of respect for your spouse. At least that's what you're manifesting. And if a woman is coming on to you, then tell your wife. Don't keep it a secret. Don't coddle that little secret there and go, well, I'll tell her everything else, but not this. Tell your wife, and if necessary, have her help you resolve the issue. I would think that might happen very well, if necessary, okay? And that goes both ways, women. Tell your husband if there's some man who is doing that, and that might take care of the problem right there. The point here is that infidelity destroys the trust and the purity and the honor in marriage, and that takes a long time to restore, if ever. And I think we've all seen it. We've all seen that get destroyed, and we've seen it take a long time, years, if not decades, to really recover from that, if a person really recovers and completely at all. It can ruin marriages, it can ruin families, it can even ruin the reputation of congregations. And yes, it contributes to the breakdown of society, as I had mentioned in an earlier lesson. In other words here, pay attention to the warnings and don't be undefended against this ambush. And you might recall what Hebrews 13:4 says, marriage is to be held in honor above among all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled. Fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Give you a little inspiration there, okay? A little of incentive to stay on the path. The second ambush, we're going to call materialism. Really, it's greed, but I think it's probably more familiarly known as materialism. I don't have time to do these subjects justice, so we'll be very brief in our comments. You don't have to be rich to be ensnared by materialism. You just have to allow greedy desire to come into your heart and take control. And the best illustration I could have of that is like Judas himself, where it says in John 13, verse 27, that Judas allowed, really, Satan to come into his heart to do that dirty deed that he did, to betray his Lord. Satan never would have had that opportunity if Judas had never opened the door. You think about that. Judas actually invited Satan in, and then Satan went in and started doing all the damage just because he let him in. So that's what materialism is like. That greed gets into our heart, and then it just starts festering and destroying things and disrupting things, all because we let it in there in the first place. Materialism is not just a love of money or possessions or things by themselves, okay? It is all that. It's a love of money and possessions and material things, but it also manifests a deep dissatisfaction, rather, for the promises and the gifts and the spiritual blessings that God provides instead. In other words, just like with your wife, you're taking your eyes off your wife and you're seeing another woman. Here, you're taking your eyes off God and you're looking at something of the world. It's very similar. In this sense, then, materialism is not just a desire for wealth, but it's also an unbelief in God. It is idolatry. That's how the Bible portrays it, is idolatry. You're taking your worship off of God, and you're putting your worship on something else. Doesn't matter what it is. In this case, it happens to be greed. Matthew chapter 6, verse 19 through 21 here, don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. And where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. That's part of the reading that was read for us in the scripture reading here. In other words, in seeking after some small material gain, a person is going to lose very much. And that's just not acceptable. So it's easy to succumb to this ambush here. And you have to understand that it is an ambush, especially people are susceptible when, first of all, they're bombarded with greed-driven advertising. Don't tell me that's not out there, okay? That really describes the kind of advertising that we are just immersed in all the time, is greed-driven advertising. Secondly, there's a person who's unhappy with his present circumstances. And then thirdly, there's someone else enjoying the good life, and they want a part of that. Envy, right, is driving this. Jealousy, very much related to this here. So in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10 and 11, the love of money is the root, not evil in itself, but the root of all sorts of evil. And some, by longing it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. But flee from these things, you man of God, Paul says to Timothy, pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, perseverance, and gentleness. I understand that you cannot buy a new car or new furniture with godliness, faith, love, perseverance, and gentleness. So there's some tangible things here that you have to relinquish and hold on to the greater things, which are virtuous but invisible in essence. Okay, so that is part of the difficulty right here. But you have to realize that all the things that you can buy will someday be completely worthless and destroyed, whereas these things, these virtues, are priceless and eternal. That's what you have to get to. You have to look at that car or that furniture or wardrobe or whatever it is that your mind is becoming obsessed with and say, that would be nice if I could afford it, if I needed it. But what I really want is what he mentions here: righteousness, godliness, faith, love, perseverance, gentleness. If I've got those things, I am rich indeed. And I'm not only rich for this life, but I am rich in the life to come. That's how you have to think. Not because I said so, and not because it's just we're deluding ourselves, but because that is the right way in which God has taught us. 1 Timothy chapter 6, in verse 17, instruct those who are rich in this present world to abandon all their riches and give it all up. He doesn't say that. He says, don't be conceited or fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. So learn to be content with what God supplies as opposed to what is advertised on TV or what other people have. This is a learned behavior. It is not automatic. You have to teach yourself or be taught these things. And you have to practice that. We just can't afford to lose our souls for a few little trinkets of the world or a few little trinkets of worldly pleasure. We have to be prepared for the ambush because it will happen. The third ambush is the biggest one of all. And the other two are all part of this, in essence. The third ambush is the ambush of pride. That self-exalting, self-serving, worldly spirit that resists and rebels against God. Pride can be described as seeking satisfaction in someone or something other than Christ. That's what pride is, in essence. Seeking satisfaction in something or someone other than Christ. And we're not talking about in a momentary way. We're talking about in a worship sense, in a fulfilling sense, in a I'm seeking, you know, to fill my cravings and desires with this something else rather than with Christ. It opposes the leadership of the Holy Spirit. Pride asserts itself as an equal, if not superior, authority to God. Pride says, my way is just as good as God's, if not better. That's how pride talks. Pride does not focus on spiritual blessings and promises, but on the here and now. What can I get now? What can I do now? How can I be honored now? What or who can I control now? That's what pride is all about, is the here and now. It does not look beyond into the future and look at long-term blessings or strategies or anything like that. All it's concerned about is what can I do for myself right now? Pride stands in defiance to God, and it will not let go of its own power. Pride does not exercise godly love, self-denial, or a servant's heart. It is obsessed with, above all else, self-gratification. And that's the motive for everything that it does. Your pride, if you allow it to be in control, will be obsessed with self-gratification. And it may even look good on the surface. You may look benevolent and kind and caring and compassionate on the surface, but what's driving all that is there's some kind of gratifying experience you're deriving from doing all those things, and that's pride in action. Pride is often subtle and unsuspecting. It manifests itself thus in the most unsuspecting of places. For example, whenever you take credit for God's gifts, your talents, your skills, your circumstances, your job, your income, right? All the things that you had everything to do with, right? Oh, no. But pride says you did. Right? Pride says, you know, I'm sure God's off there in the distance somewhere and kind of applauding me for all that I've done. But the fact is, I am responsible for my job and for my great income and for my circumstances and my retirement account. And I've done all these things. I've done all these things. You can hear pride just bellowing there. Me, me, me. I. The pride is talking when God's word says, do this, and pride says, I will not do this. Or God's word says, don't do this, and pride says, I will do this. I know we never see that today in the church. But if we did, I'm being facetious here, right? If we did, that would be pride talking. Pride manifests itself when we rely on our own resources, our own livelihood, our own strength, our own solutions, rather than on the strength of His might. The Old Testament, if you want a storybook of sad accounts of people and nations who have done it all wrong, look in the Old Testament. You will find a lot of people and a lot of nations who resisted God and stiffened their neck and just were arrogant toward God, and they all survived and all went well with them, didn't it? No. Every single one of them went down in flames. I mean, they all crash and burn. They all suffer dearly the consequences of those actions. And you will be no different if indeed you live by your own pride. Pride manifests itself when a person relies on his own good works and noble virtues. Imagine that, taking something very good, okay, stirring it up in, with a little bit of pride, and it sours it and spoils it, and now it's rotten and corrupted. So pride can take some very good things and turn them into some really ugly, awful, evil things. James chapter 4, verse 4, 6, and 10, I'm just kind of skipping around to make the point here. James says, "You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, in the presence of God, and he will exalt you." And Peter adds to that, he'll exalt you at the proper time. So the message is there. And isn't this interesting that James calls these people adulteresses? And we kind of started out talking in the first ambush about, in essence, adulteress or an adulterer. There's a lot of relation between these different ambushes here, and pride is very much involved in that. The thing here is that God cannot do anything with a proud person. He's unteachable. He will not learn. He cannot learn because he's unteachable. So we need to be very careful not to allow pride to creep into our heart and begin calling the shots. Because of all the ambushes that Satan uses, pride is one of the easiest for him, the most effective, and the most unsuspecting. You and I have all been warned now. So be prepared for this attack, because this one will happen. If the other two don't happen, this one will happen, and it will happen more than once. We can't avoid the ambushes, but we can and are expected to be prepared to resist them when they happen. That doesn't mean we live in constant fear and paranoia, like, what was that? Was that an ambush? You know, I mean, it's not like that, okay, that we're supposed to live like that, but we are supposed to be aware and vigilant. God has defined the enemy. He's described the enemy. We may not see him coming, but when he begins to attack, we must identify him for who he is. He is the enemy. And then we must know what to do then when we are attacked by this enemy and not make ourselves vulnerable to his advances. Ambushes are meant to cut us down in the middle of a race. We're here running along and we're thinking everything is fine, and boom, out of the woods, right? Sniper attack, hit and run, whatever it is, guerrilla warfare. That's how Satan works. And if you have not put on the full armor of God, then you are not protected. If you have put on the full armor of God and maintained that armor, well, then you have more than sufficient protection. There's no reason why any of us should stop running just because we're ambushed. So the question comes down to, what about you? Are you protected against these ambushes? Are you engaged regularly in prayer and study and fellowship? That's all part of it, too. Are you wearing that full armor of God? Or are you saying something like, well, I'm smart enough. I'm not going to fall for any of those silly ambushes. And if that's your thinking, then you've already fallen for one of them. And I would strongly advise you to come to your senses quickly, if that is you, while you still have an opportunity to do so. Okay? This is serious stuff. We need to take it very seriously. If there's anyone subject to our invitation tonight, if you need to respond by coming forward this evening, this would be the time in our service where that would be most appropriate. As we stand and sing the song that has been selected.